Welcome to a new edition of the Neon Jazz Interview Series with beloved virtuoso, trumpeter, arranger, bandleader, and composer Stephen Bernstein. We caught up with him in mid-January 2022 to talk about a host of projects that he has coming out, the COVID-19 world, and his life in music. Over the years, he's been the musical director for the Kansas City Band from Robert Altman's film Kansas City, and he's released four albums under his own name on John Zorn's label. And he has performed with jazz giants like Roswell Rudd, Sam Rivers, Don Byron, Medeski, Martin, and Wood, as well as musicians that range from Aretha Franklin to the great Lou Reed. He's full of great stories, wisdom, and energy. Enjoy.
Hey, man. Steve, thanks for taking a minute out for the show. I appreciate it.
No problem. I'm really pleased to be doing this.
Since March of 2020, the snow globe has been turned upside down and violently shook. How have you been making out?
I've actually been kind of really okay. I'm a very lucky person. I've been through a lot of shit in my life. Actually, I've been through a lot of tragedy in my life and a lot of beauty in my life, so I think I have a very good perspective on things. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I think some people, if they've never had their life turned upside down before, and it's the first time this happened, you don't have chops, right? I have chops. I know what it's like to have your life turned upside down. I said, okay, let's figure out how we do this. And I'm lucky enough that a real miracle is that I had toured with Little Feat the year before and was paid, you know, regular, you know, on a payroll with money taken out. So I was eligible for unemployment, which would have never happened in my normal life, and it just so happened that the year before I was touring with Little Feat, so that was really helped me out. There were grants given to people like me. I was very lucky to get both grants I applied for and didn't apply for, and so I was able to just lead a kind of beautiful artistic life for a while and just focus on, I was just practicing. I was buying low brass instruments. I learned to record at home, and then I mixed 5 records. Not a bad way to spend a year, you know?
No, yeah, and I guess that's been the idea, silver lining. So what did you discover about yourself that maybe you didn't realize before all this started? And how do you think that will make you, hopefully, things open up and reemerge in 2022?
Oh, very interesting, because what I found out about myself is I like being at home. I've been on the road for 40 years. I don't know what that means. It's like, wow, to go back into hotels and do that life. I mean, I turned 22 on the road. I'm 60 years old. Yeah, I turned 22 in a hotel. Let's see what happens. I the idea at this point of, like, you know, taking 2 planes and then getting on 2 trains and playing a gig in Europe sounds like, wow, did I really do that for decades and decades and decades? It's like, but I guess I'll do it again. Supposed to go out with Little Feat. In fact, I'll be in Kansas City in either April or May, March or April. And so that'll be a very, in a sense, an easy tour because it's going to be very contained. You know, rock tours, you live on a bus, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, so many of these tours have been, like, suspended halfway through. I see everything as alleged at this point, so I'll tell you something interesting is that, you know, I learned a lot more about the world outside of my world because I was at home and you're Googling things and you're kind of like, you're not surrounded by the things you've been surrounded by your whole life. You're not surrounded by your community. So I kind of think it's going to be interesting to get back out in the world and play my own music. That's really what I'm looking forward to doing and see what that means now because kind of feel like people like me, I'm older now, you know what I'm saying? I'm not, there's always going to be, people want to have the freshness of youth because that's always the new flavor, the new ideas, you know, that's what keeps our culture moving forward. But I also feel at this point, you know, I have an important message to give to people about, like, the lineage at this point.
So piggybacking off of that notion, when you do actually get out, we kind of get to full force. What do you hope we all realize about the power of live music, both musician and the audience?
Well, I don't hope because I know people realize it. I've been along, you know, I don't know if you know about the band I had with Henry Butler called The Hot Nine. So I've been a band leader for 30 years, and I've always believed in transformation. I've always believed that my job is to take the audience somewhere. You know, it's interesting because I'm reading right now, someone sent me Ken Babbs's book. I don't know if you know, Ken Babbs was Ken Kesey's second in command. When I first joined the Lounge Lizards, in 1990. And are you familiar with the Lounge Lizards?
Absolutely, yes.
So you know that was like the biggest band in New York of music. Like writers didn't know about it, and jazz people didn't know about it, but music fans were, that was the band. And in Europe, they played for thousands of people. And I kind of looked at this world around them, and I realized, right, this is the world that's connected to Andy Warhol and Kesey, this world of, and in a sense, even though not musically, but almost like ideologically, the world of transformation, the world of trance, the world of like vibrational change. And I kind of, and with Henry and Butler and myself, we would talk about the fact that our job is to transform the audience. Like, my job is not to play good music. Like, whatever. Anyone can play good music. You go to school and you learn to play good. Like, not that hard. Just practice. But transforming an audience, a different kind of alchemy. You know what I'm saying? It's a different science. And there is a science to it. And I feel like that's, you know, I'm just going to be happy to be out there doing that for people. And I've never had an issue with it. Like, I don't feel like it's something I need for people to find out now. I think anytime I've played, people know that's why they come to hear what I do, because something's going to happen and you'll feel it. And we're going to do it together. You know, the audience is part of the experience as well. It's not just about musicians playing music. It's about a community. And the community is the audience, musicians, fans. When you're in the right venue, it's the venue's part of the community too.
So let's go back to the beginnings of your life. You know, there's always this flashpoint. There's always this gateway into the music and the jazz. How did that happen for you? What made you get to the point where you're at today, and you've been a veteran jazz musician for all these years?
Well, the funny thing, I love being called a jazz musician, but you can just call me a musician. It's interesting because, you know, so much of my life has been, you know, hey, playing with Levon Helm, playing with Lou Reed, playing with Bill Laswell, playing with Little Feat, you know. And yes, I am a jazz musician, but I feel like I'm a musician that comes from the world of jazz. And if you want to call me a jazz musician, that's fine, you know, because I listen to Duke Ellington and Louis Armstrong as much as anyone in the world ever. I listen to Duke Ellington every day of my life for about 30 years. I'm not kidding when I say every day of my life. It was like coffee. It was like, yeah, I had to have Duke Ellington to exist. That's how much I love this music. I've been thinking about this lately because people have been asking me about this second volume of the Community Music Series, and people keep referring to New Orleans and Louis Armstrong, even though it wasn't a conscientious thing on my part with this record. The flavor was. But I was thinking about it, and I when my parents moved, I found old scrapbooks, and man, as far as me figuring this out, I think what happened was that in third grade, my mom took me to see Preservation Hall Jazz Band, and I didn't play an instrument yet, but it had a really strong effect on me, and I really remember that concert. And then in the fourth grade, they say, oh, can you pick an instrument? And I said, okay, I'll pick trumpet because I like Louis Armstrong. And I was doing like, I found that like book reports on Louis Armstrong in fourth grade. So I had some sort of magnetic attraction to this music going that far back, man, 9, 10 years old. Is that crazy or what?
Man, that's beautiful. I love that. That was what I was going to ask you. What was your first show? And that right there, that's the ultimate gateway. I mean, I would love to see that in the flesh. You know, and you touched on Lou Reed, and there's a lot of people that you arced into their worlds over the years. What have these legends and luminaries taught you about not only being in the music industry and being a journeyman musician, but about being a human?
Well, you know, I'll tell you something interesting. Hal Wilner, who, you know, was really my kind of gateway into this whole world of, like, these kind of people, these kind of situations, when Lou died and, you know, Robert Altman had died, and Lou died, and Badhead had died, and, you know, Levon had died, all these people, and for Hal, like, you know, Gil Evans, and, you know, all these people he had kind of looked up to and worked with, he said, you know, Steven, we now need to be our own heroes. We need to do work with that intent. And one thing that all the people, whether I've met, whether it was like a Robert Altman or a Lou Reed or whoever, a Levon, it's like all very different kind of people. It's their intent. Their intent was unquestioning. Do you know what I'm saying? And I'll say something interesting about all three of them. Like, when I was with Lou, no one really cared. I made three records with Lou Reed. I don't think anyone cared about him. But when he died, it was like this huge thing. And I was like, wow. Like, you know, but Lou had had, as Hal would say, Lou had his hits. Lou had Perfect Day and Walk on the Wild Side, and that put him in a certain place in American society. Now, maybe the film I did with Robert Altman wasn't, you know, his masterpiece, but the interesting thing about someone like Altman, he really believed in improvisation and making, he believed in like making a movie. That's what he believed in. And maybe the product, the intent wasn't so much what the final product was. The intent was making the movie. And again, he had a couple movies that were hits, but most of his movies people didn't really care about. And, you know, before we started the Rambles with Levon, Levon had been, you know, had lost his voice. The band was, he was in bad shape with, you know, with personal issues and cancer left. And, you know, he was like playing little dives in New York, you know. And at the end of his life, he was, you know, like a beloved, you know, huge figure again. And so one of the things you can say I learned from these people is like, you don't really know what the story is. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, the story keeps changing. The story is always evolving. The story is always moving.
It most certainly is. It's fluid. You know, and as you mentioned, you've been around for a long time. You toured for a long time. You're 60. You've had a lot of things happen in your career. When you kick back and think back and look back on your career, what are you the proudest of? What happened in your career that maybe someone doesn't realize that you're like, man, I'm so glad that happened?
Okay, check this out. I played Duke Ellington's Nutcracker on the road for a couple of years at wintertime for, it was Donald Byrd, the choreographer Donald Byrd, had choreographed this incredible thing called the Harlem Nutcracker. David Berger, who is an unrecognized hero in American music, who transcribed Ellington's music and was the one who got it to Winton. He was the original conductor of Jazz Lincoln Center. And he's the one that, like, kind of guided that. You know, that's become this huge thing of a rebirth of Ellington in the schools. I've always been into Ellington, like I told you. Like, so I shouldn't say always. Maybe second half of 11th grade on. And that's when I kind of got bitten by the bug. We did this thing of playing Ellington's music in the band. I don't know if you know these names, but Britt Woodman, who had played trombone with Ellington for, you know, easily a decade, and he played the most incredible solos on like Cut Sweet Thunder, and he was on the original of Nutcracker. Art Barron on trombone, who played in Duke's band at the end. Jerome Richardson and Jerry Donjan on saxophones, who two of the greatest, you know, saxophonists of that era, who've been playing together since they were teenagers. Dennis Irwin on the bass. Marcus Belgrave on trumpet next to me, and then Bob Milliken on lead. So I'm playing with like the greatest guys playing this music, playing Ellington's music. And it was, you know, if you're not a musician, you wouldn't know what it is to play with someone like Jerome Richardson or Britt Woodman. But if you're a musician, you know what it means. It's like, I guess in sports, you'd be playing with, I don't know who's famous and the best, but, you know, like the best sports dude. Whoever it is, these guys were the best, you know. And yeah. They were in their, I think both of them were 70 at the time, or even in their early 70s. And I was 40. You know what I'm saying? So it was amazing to be around the people that had that. Yeah. So that was very, you know, these are the guys that had done everything. They had played with Mingus. They had played every record possible. They had, like, they had the real knowledge. As musicians and people have survived, because the music is not an easy life, man. I mean, you know, I raised a family without a steady job. That's not the easiest thing in the world to do.
Absolutely. Well, and I guess that's the thing. You've been at this for a long time. What's been the key to your longevity and your relevance? You've always stayed relevant. You've always evolved, and you've been around for a long time, almost four decades plus. How did that happen?
I love music, man, and I'm always writing, and I have my own band. And because I have my own band, and I always bring a new arrangement. I've had Sex Mob for, for 25 or 30 years. I think we're getting on 30 years of Sex Mob. No, I shouldn't say that. It's 27 years. And a little more than 25 years. But I'll bring a new composition or arrangement to every gig. Like, I never go to a gig and without bringing a new piece of paper and saying, let's try this. You know, so I'm always curious. And trumpet's a very hard instrument. You have to practice. You know, I practice 2-3 hours a day every day. And I'm adding new instruments, so I'm always, you know, trying to kind of learn new things, you know, between like the slide trumpet and getting lower brass instruments. So I'm always trying to expand what I can do. And the thing is, because I really love a lot of music, and you have to, I explain that to some jazz musicians, you know, like, man, if you don't love Lou Reed, you're not going to be able to play his music. The music is about love, not just, like, the notes aren't that, yes, you have to be able to play the notes, it's your job. It's like saying, like, if you're a bus driver, you have to know how to steer a bus. It's like, of course you need to play the notes, but it's bigger than that, where, you know, really, because we were talking about the beginning, like, what's this about? This is about transformation. And even if every little part, every cog in that wheel is important and it should be done with the utmost, like, love and intensity and intent and care and knowledge of history, you know? The thing is, and because I love to listen, I'm always learning more about music. You know, I'm learning, you know, that that's why I kind of feel like at this point it's weird to think of it because people think, oh, Sex Mob and punk rock. But I am someone, like, carrying a legacy forward of all these older musicians that I was around.
Right on. So everyone has a perception of you, an idea of who they think you are, your family, your friends, your fans. But ultimately, you live your life. You have a perception of you. Who do you think you are?
I don't know. Guy that likes playing the trumpet a lot. And figured out a bunch of other stuff to do. Yeah. You know, I'm like, I love playing. Someone was saying, man, don't you miss playing for audiences? I say, yeah, but, you know, I like just being in my room playing the trumpet. Like, I mean, I love playing the trumpet. It's super fun to, like, play for audiences. It's a whole other thing. But it's weird. I tell people, like, maybe in a sense I got some arrested development because I've just been there playing the trumpet for, like, decades now. I just put a piece of metal in my face and start playing it and just want to get better at it. I know it sounds weird.
Yeah,
my friend was like, no. Hey, so much more than that. I'm like, yeah, but that's what I really like to do.
Yeah. There's a place that I go to every once in a while here in town, Casey Beer Company, and there's a guy named Brahm, and he's a piano player, but he plays the accordion, and there's a guy with him that's a spoonist, and he plays spoons. And he sat down during an intermission, and we started talking, and he's kind of an anxious guy. And he said, when March 2020 happened, it was the best thing in the world that happened to me. I got to stay home, and I got to completely get rid of all my social engagements. And he was 100% serious. He said it was the greatest thing. Because, you know, you hear about the woe and the sorrow and all of these things, but he was like, he had a glint in his eye that was like a diamond. He was so happy.
Very funny story. Funny.
Yeah. So, but anyways, man, hey, Steven, thank you for taking a minute out from Neon Jazz today. Thank you for the music.
I hope you play some of the music while we're in the middle of this interview so you don't just hear me blabbing away, because I'm really proud of these first two records. And let me just say, I mean, just because this is what we do in this business, there's, you know, the record with Cat Russell's out right now and people are really loving it. And then the next record is a tribute to Henry Butler with John Medeski and Arturo Farrell. And then the classic MTO playing Eddie Harris and the Beatles and the Grateful Dead and Bessie Smith, etc. And there's a new Sex Mob record coming out with Scott Harding that's going to come out on with Corbett versus Dempsey, which is also a beautiful label. You know, it's Royal Potato putting out the four volumes of MTO, but there's a lot of music out there. So if you're all interested and want to support live or recorded music or living musicians, please check it out.
Thank you, man. I really appreciate it. Good luck as we move forward, and I appreciate it.
Right on, man. Bye.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players in New York City, Kansas City, and spots all over the world, giving fans all that jazz. And thanks to Steven for his time, music, and stories. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Domino in the iTunes Store. Visit NeonJazz at YouTube.com, and for everything Neon Jazz all the time, go to the NeonJazz.blogspot.com. Until next time, enjoy the jazz, my friends.
Neon Jazz.